Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Mark Schwain, and I come to the village from Valparaiso, Indiana, where I teach at Valparaiso University. My spouse is Dorothy Bass, who's coordinating the summer teaching staff, and I've been helping out a little bit with that. And this week, I'm offering some sessions on the life and work of Norman MacLean. Just out of curiosity, today's session, as you know, is on River Runs Through It. How many of you have seen the film but not read the book? Okay. How many of you have read the book but not seen the film? Nobody. How many of you have read the book and seen the film? Okay. And how many of you have neither read the book nor seen the film? That's good. That's good. Kind of a nice mixed group. So I will try to pitch this on the assumption that you're here to get a kind of an introduction to this work. The work plan for the week was that yesterday I talked for a while about Norman's life and how it was that he came to write the two major books for which he will always be remembered, River Runs Through It and Young Men in Fire. We will talk about then River Runs Through It, both the novella, kind of a short novel or a long short story, depending on your point of view, and the film this afternoon, and then we'll show the film, as I think all of you know, this evening. And then tomorrow we'll talk about the other major work, Young Men in Fire. And then the next day we'll talk about what I call his theology, the kind of, I think, deepest level of several levels of meaning in these two, I think, great books. So you can come and go as you please. Each section or each session, as Holden sessions are, will be self-contained. And by all means, come and see the film tonight. I will hang around afterwards for those who are really Norman MacLean fans and or fans of that film, and talk about it with you at that time in addition to this session. So since I'll be here this evening after the film to consider with you some questions that an actual viewing of the whole thing raises, I think I'll concentrate in this session on the novella, the book. Just a few things about then the background to this book. As those of you who were here yesterday learned, Norman didn't really start even to write fiction until he had retired at the age of 70 from the University of Chicago in 1973. He had written two works of criticism during the entire time he was a professor at the University of Chicago from 1928 on. While there, he won the Outstanding Teaching Award that the university gives three times. He would not get tenure today with that kind of scholarly output. He took 12 years to get his PhD from the time he came there in 1928 as a kind of teaching assistant, but he did a lot of teaching then until 1940 when his PhD was conferred. And it was his children who urged him upon his retirement to write some stories of reminiscence because he talked so often with them about his own growing up in Montana. So from 1973 until 1975, he worked on River Runs Through It, which was then published in 1976. And then it wasn't until after he had died that they brought out Young Men in Fire. That was posthumously published because it was unfinished at the time of his death. Largely because, as you'll learn tomorrow, I don't think he really could finish it. Not because of physical weakness, but because of the sort of emotional task, and really the artistic task he had set for himself in that book, which was huge. Most people will remember River Runs Through It as being the more perfect of the two books. It, of course, is a finished work. I think, almost perfectly shaped and formed, a work of tremendous power and great beauty. The film was made in the early 90s, released in 1992. The film is also beautiful. Its wonders are largely, I think, derived from the fact that Redford, who made this film, did not try to simply follow in some kind of close and literal way the plot of the book. I think the films that are most successful based on books don't try to duplicate them in some kind of straightforward way on film, because obviously film works in visual images and books don't always do that. And so I think the screenwriter here was very ingenious in including all kinds of episodes and events and actions that you don't have in the book, and still was nonetheless faithful to the spirit and to the major themes of the book. For instance, you will see tonight, some of you again, some of you for the first time, that long stretches of the film involve the courtship between Norman and the young woman he was to marry, Jessie Burns. None of that is in the short story. In the world of the short story, he's already married by the time the action of the book takes place, and so none of that courtship is there. A great deal of the relationship between the two brothers, Norman and Paul, is dramatized in the film through episodes and incidents that don't take place in the book. One of the ones that's most memorable in the film that you'll see is the two daring brothers kind of defying the odds and running the rapids when most people think they won't make it. That kind of dramatizes their toughness, their sometimes recklessness. They go over the border from courage to recklessness. And that's told in the voice of the narrator in the story, but not dramatized quite as extensively as the film does. So the film relies on incident and action that aren't in the story to bring out aspects of the characterization that the narrator does in words in the story. So I don't find it at all troubling that the film invents these episodes and incidents, because I think that throughout the screenwriter remains faithful to the book, and Norman felt that way as well. Many directors sought to make a film based on that book, and he consistently turned them down. And it was only when Redford persisted and suggested this particular procedure that Norman agreed to follow, which is that they would meet three times with 6 weeks intervals in between, talk together, and hopefully build a sense of trust, which Redford thought was essential, and so did Norman, which they succeeded in doing. And then he gave Norman a kind of right to pull the plug at any time in the process. Norman didn't live to see the whole process through, but he did see the whole screenplay, which was completed by 1990, shortly before his death, actually, and did approve that. So we know that he agreed with the kind of thing I'm saying now, namely that the film did a great job of capturing the atmosphere, the major themes, the tonalities, and in a sense, the shape of the novella. So we'll talk more about the film tonight. That's really all I'm going to say about it now. I'm going to really now talk about the book. I encourage all of you who haven't read it to read it. It's, as I said, a novella. It's about 100 pages long. It is so wonderfully and fluently composed in a kind of simple, spare, direct, but beautiful diction that you often aren't aware of how very carefully and wonderfully it's constructed. And what I want to do now is to spend a little bit of time talking about its structure, and then talk about its major shape as a tragedy, which Norman always insisted that it was, by focusing upon a kind of fugue that runs through all four of its major parts. And I'll read you some passages. This fugue is about the whole theme of whether or not it's possible always to help those whom we love, and when we can't, why we can't, and so forth. That's the major sort of theme that constitutes the tragedy of this work. And then if there's time, I'll talk about some other dimensions of it, particularly the great last passage, which I had shown to the group that met yesterday. But don't hesitate to interrupt me with questions anytime you want. So first, then, something about the structure of River Runs Through It. It's a book that has four very clearly demarcated parts. Each part has at its center an episode of fishing. So there are four fishing episodes in four parts. In fact, an undergraduate student that Norman was listening in on an undergraduate class at a community college discussed his book, and one of the students was called upon to summarize the plot, and she said, first they go fishing, then they go fishing again, then they get drunk, then they go fishing once more, and that's the end. Norman laughed and said, well, she came pretty close to getting it right. Actually, they go fishing four times, not three, and they really don't get drunk together, though there is some drunkenness in the book. Each of the four sections not only involves centrally fishing, but each is divided from the other, and each is about 25 pages long. By a trip from one part of Montana to another in a very limited locale, from Helena to Wolf Creek, or from Wolf Creek to Helena, or from either of those two places to spots on the Blackfoot River or the Blackfoot River or the Elkhorn River where they fish. So it really is very centrally, and you can say this, at one level, a book about fishing. And as I told the group yesterday, it's one of the few books where you get consistently high praise from literary critics and very consistently high praise from fishing magazines and from people who really understand fly fishing. And in fact, some people have testified they've learned fly fish by reading this book because he's so meticulously detailed about what it's like to fly fish, beginning with what it's like to cast, that you can, if you follow through step by step, pretty much learn all that you need to learn about fly fishing. So this is what I mean about multiple levels. The deepest, I think, is a theological level, but it's very much a book about fly fishing because, as I say, its four major parts have at their center an episode of fly fishing. For a long time, I was puzzled in reading the book, knowing that it has a kind of tragic shape that it should have, because I knew Norman was a great student of Shakespeare. One of his critical essays was on Shakespeare's King Lear, and the other one was on Wordsworth's poetry. And of course, those of you who know Shakespeare would know that a typical Shakespearean tragedy would have five acts, not four. And other plays are often structured tragedies in other by other authors in three acts. Rarely, if ever, in fact, I can't think of one, you get a four-act tragedy. And of course, this puzzled me a long time until I realized I was overlooking the obvious. Right on the second page of the book, you learn that fly fishing is a four-count rhythm. And he talks about how, basically, when you learn to fly fish, you pick up one of God's rhythms through this four-count beat, which his father taught both of the brothers. And so he has structured, I think, River Runs Through It itself according to a kind of four-count rhythm. If you look further at these structural parts, you will see that they themselves are divided into parts, very discrete scenes, with the fishing scene always being the central one. And you'll discover further this beautifully parallel structure between the first and the fourth part. The first part has a nice long prologue, and the last part has a nice long coda. And then as you move first and fourth part, you get a kind of complicating action at the beginning. Part one, Norman is in Helena talking with his brother, about a problem that he has, the problem being that his mother-in-law has asked him to enlist Paul, his brother, in looking after or helping Norman's brother-in-law, his wife's brother, a guy named Neil, by taking him fishing. And Norman knows that Paul will not like this much, but persuades him to engage in this. But before they face Neil, Neil hasn't yet arrived, they decide to go fishing together. On the way, they have conversations, and Paul reveals the younger brother by 3 years to his older brother Norman that he's in some trouble. He smashed up the car. Norman wonders whether this is a response, a request for help. But then they go fishing, and as they're fishing, Norman very briefly describes his own catching of a fish, describes elaborately his thinking about how to catch the fish. He's a thinker. His whole action of catching the fish is covered in the words, then I cast, and I caught him. That's the whole description of Norman's fishing. But then he sits on a bank and watches his brother casting. And his brother is a brilliant caster, and the description in language of that particular moment of his brother shadow casting, pivoting back and forth, kind of paints him almost as a kind of Greek heroic figure, being able to do things with a fly rod that no one's ever seen before. So you have Norman on the bank watching his brother, and two people join them, and one of them, as though you need another larger audience to confirm Norman's own impressions, a woman wearing bib overalls simply takes one look at the young man casting and says, "Jesus." That's her only word. She's just astounded by this. So basically then, from the height of this heroic pose in the midst of this river, they finish fishing, and then Norman goes back to sleep in the apartment where his brother lives, and he's awakened by the phone when the sergeant calls and says that the brother is in deep trouble, that he's been in a fight, and that he needs rescue, needs to be bailed out, and Norman goes to rescue him. So it goes from the height of achievement there, this great heroic figure doing things with a fly rod no one ever has, into being in the drunk tank with his girlfriend for having gotten into a bar fight and Norman rescued him. That's the first part. Fourth part parallels that exactly. Here you have another fishing trip. This time the three go, the two boys and their father. The father and Norman sit on the bank after they finish fishing, again watching Paul. Structural parallel, it's perfect. And then after that is seen, you get the tragic move to the Paul that this time comes, that his brother has been beaten to death and left in an alley. So again, from the heights of achievement, his brother catching this magnificent trout into now his death. So those first and fourth parts are perfectly structurally parallel, each having this business about someone witnessing the brother at the heights of achievement, and then this sudden fall from grace. The two middle sections, again, have a very similar structure. Again, as I told you, they involve centrally fishing, and they involve centrally the relationship between these two brothers, who work out that relationship always in the water. I was struck today in listening to Gretchen and her session about homes, how little of this book takes place indoors. Almost everything happens out of doors. There is one central scene involving the efforts of three women, Norman's wife, Norman's wife's mother, and Norman's sister-in-law to tend to Neil, who has been overexposed in the sun, and their ministrations to him take place indoors. But for the most part, except for that scene and one other in Norman's home, everything is outdoors. Okay, that gives you some sense of the structure. But I've indicated this book has a kind of tragic shape. A tragic shape that is sort of indicated to you as is the major theme of the relationship between those two brothers and the world that they share right at the very beginning. On page 6 already of the book, the narrator says simply about his brother, this is Norman now, speaking of him and Paul, "We had to be very careful in dealing with each other. I often thought of him as a boy, but I never could treat him that way. He was never my kid brother. He was a master of an art. He did not want any big brother advice or money or help. And in the end, I could not help him." So there you get right there on page 6, a kind of, not just foreshadowing, but a kind of succinct statement of what the central dramatic action of this whole work is going to be. It's going to involve the whole question of helping, and it's going to involve the relationship between these two brothers, and in the end, you already sense part of the tragedy is going to be that in the end, not only Norman, but no one could really help Paul. And then, as I told you before, the first part has this long prologue, and just before you get to the initiating action of the plot, on pages 8 to 9, we get this paragraph, which is a beautiful paragraph, and that tells you and signals the deep theological theme of this book. It talks about both brothers being tough but in different ways, and it describes a fight they once had, only once, in front of their mother who tried to break them apart. And then he points out that I guess since neither one of them won, they never knew ever which one of the two was the tougher. And he continues, "Perhaps we always wondered which one of us was tougher. But if boyhood questions aren't answered before a certain point in time, they can't ever be raised again. So we returned to being gracious to each other, as the wall suggested that we should be." There was a wall in their Sunday school that said, "God is love." And they always thought, the narrator says, that that was addressed just to the four of them, the mother, the father, and the two boys. So he says, they returned to being gracious to each other as the wall suggested that we should be. "We also felt that the woods and rivers were gracious to us when we walked together beside them." So you have here now toughness, who's tougher, and toughness always involves exertion, competition, effort, struggle. But on the other hand, this kind of graciousness. So you have there already a kind of struggle on the one hand, a kind of grace on the other, and you have their nature being gracious to both of them. So you have nature and grace, you have grace and effort, you have those kinds of deep currents, and I think currents is the right metaphor here, since river is crucial, that run through this entire four parts. Let me just read you some of the sections I've pulled out here that run through all four on this issue of the question of helping. When in part one, Norman goes to bail out Paul and his girlfriend who have been thrown into the drunk tank after this fight, he runs into the Irish desk sergeant and he confesses, and this is the word, quote, "I don't know what to do, I confessed to the sergeant." Confess is an important word here, I think. "I know what you mean," the sergeant confessed to me. "I have a young brother," he said, who is a wonderful kid, but he's always in trouble. He's what we call Black Irish. What do you do to help him? I asked. After a long pause, he said, I take him fishing. And when that doesn't work, I asked, well, you better go see your own brother, he answered. So already there's this conversation that works on Norman's mind, because in the scene subsequent to that, when part two begins, he's driving over the Continental Divide, an hour's drive from Helena to Wolf Creek, going through sunlight and shadow. It's always important whether you're in sunlight and shadow and where you are geographically in terms of what you think in this book. And as he says here, traveling this distance. Sunrise is the time to feel that you will be able to find out how to help somebody close to you who you think needs help, even if he doesn't think so. At sunrise, everything is luminous, but not clear. And then the car continues into the darkness of Prickly Pear Canyon, which is all in shadow. And he says, hell, my brother is not like anybody else. He's my brother, and he's an artist. And when a 4.5-ounce rod is in his hand, he's a major artist. It's a shame I don't understand him. Yet even in the loneliness of the canyon, he continues, I knew there were others like me who had brothers they did not understand but wanted to help. We are probably those referred to as our brothers' keepers. Possessed of one of the oldest and possibly one of the most futile, and certainly one of the most haunting of instincts. It will not let us go. Well, you can tell even through this book to the very coda that it really never let go of Norman. Okay, so on the way then, he's thinking about his brother and whether or not he can ever come to understand him, and begins to reflect on the relationship between his ability to understand his brother and his ability to help him. He begins already to tease out this relationship. Can we help somebody if we don't understand them? Is love enough, or is understanding essential to being able to help somebody? So then we go on and we get to the next part. This is the end of part two now. And this is Paul talking to Norman about their joint effort to help old Neil. Neil's kind of a comic figure here. He's Norman's brother-in-law, and he comes in from California wearing a couple of tennis sweaters, prone to alcoholism and womanizing, as someone whom Norman despises and thinks of, in Norman's own words, as simply one of those bastards in California who is just trying to buy up the state of Montana. So he and Paul jointly then, as a kind of leitmotif here, the subplot, are assigned the task of helping this guy Neil. And here, at the end of this second scene, when they're fishing, Paul says to Norman, you really should try to help him. And then Norman says to Paul, do you think you should help him? And Paul says, yes, I thought we were going to. How? I asked. By taking him fishing with us. I've just told you, I said, he doesn't like to fish. Neil hated to fish. And besides that, worse yet, he was a bait fisherman, not a fly fisherman. And worse yet, when they're trying to help him and get fishing, he doesn't even remember to bring his tackle. Norman says, Paul's mercy only extended so far. You might want to try to help Neil, but if Neil doesn't have even the sense to bring his tackle, he falls outside the circle of mercy. But he hadn't committed that blunder yet at this part in the novel, and so Paul's still trying to encourage Norman to help. And he says, I've just told you, he doesn't like to fish. And then Paul says this, maybe so, my brother replied. But maybe what he likes is somebody trying to help him. And then Norman continues, I still do not understand my brother. He himself always turned aside any offer of help, but in some complicated way, he was surely talking about himself when he was talking about Neil needing help. So a lot of the communication in here between the two brothers is indirect, as in this example. And what you begin to notice when you start to study the actual dialogue when people are explicitly talking about helping each other, and you focus instead on the actual action between the two brothers when they're fishing, you notice that throughout the book, although Norman is always obsessed with the question of how and whether he can help Paul, when they're fishing, the person who's doing the helping is Paul, always giving Norman advice, always helping Norman fish. So if you watch them fishing, it's Paul helping Norman. If you listen to Norman thinking, he's worrying about how, in a larger sense, he can help Paul. So this is a very kind of interesting counterpuntal movement that goes throughout this entire lovely story. So now we come to part three, and more on helping. This time, Paul, again, encourages Norman to help Neil when he shows up with the whore, Neil, that he's running around with, and goes all the way over to the cabin at Sealy to interrupt Paul and Norman and ask him to take him fishing. On the drive to the Blackfoot, where they're going to fish, Norman is thinking, I was glad I didn't have to drive. I had too many things, and this is a very interesting word, I had too many things to feel about. So at the beginning of part three, Norman moves from thinking about a lot of things to feeling about a lot of things. And the exact word is, I had too many things to feel about. For instance, I felt about why women are sometimes such a bunch of suckers and how they all want to help some bastard like Neil and not me. I felt an especially long time about why, when I tried hard to help somebody, I ended up offering him money or taking him fishing. So this now is in a kind of current of feeling that he has. So he's gone from thinking about helping to feeling about helping. And then at the end of part three, we have a wonderfully tender exchange between Norman and his wife on the subject of helping. Norman and Paul have blundered. Paul's lost patience with Neil. Norman never did like Neil. And they go off fishing together while Neil and this prostitute basically decide to take off their clothes and sleep on the and cavort on an island in the middle of the river, where they fall asleep and promptly roast in the sun. And when I say roast, that's an understatement, because the comedy here is that when Norman and Paul come back, of course, there they are, lying there in the sun. And Norman, rather chagrined, because he knows he's going to come in from all these women when they get Neil home and they have to kind of try to bring him back to health, for having so blundered this effort, they ask the two brothers to help Neil, and Neil comes back looking like some kind of lobster. And as he's leaving the house, he says to his wife, his wife says to him, I'm trying to help somebody in my family. Don't you understand? I said, I should understand. I'm not able to help, she said. I should understand that too, I said. Tell me, she asked, if my brother comes back next summer, will you try to help him? It took a long time to say it, but I said it. I said, I will try. Then she said, he won't come back. Then she added, tell me, why is it that people who want to help do better without it? I'm sorry, why is it that people who want help do better without it, at least no worse? Actually, that's what it is, no worse. They take all the help they can get and are just the same as they always have been. Tell me, I asked her, if your brother comes back next summer, will we both try to help him? If he comes back, she nodded. I thought I saw tears in her eyes, but I was mistaken. In all my life, I was never to see her cry. And also, he was never to come back. Without interrupting each other, we both said at the same time, let's never get out of touch with each other. And we never have, although her death has come between us. So that ends part three, when there comes a point at which this effort of these men attempting to help each other and following up almost comes between Norman and his wife. But they are—they make sure that doesn't happen and that they never lose touch with one another. And part four then starts with something that's classic in all tragedies, a great reversal. And he even uses the word reversal to describe what's happening now, because now on this fishing trip, it's explicitly Paul who is taking Norman fishing and taking Norman fishing in order to help Norman. And the words are, our customary roles had been reversed. I was the brother who was being taken fishing for the healing effects of cool waters. He was as tender as I usually tried to be to him. And so we get this last fishing trip the two brothers take together. And it all involves complicated transactions between the two on what kind of fly to use to catch the fish. And at first, it's Norman who's succeeding, and Paul who's jealous, and Norman offering help to Paul. I know what fly I can give you. Do you want me to come across and give you this fly? Absolutely not. Later, things reverse because the hatch that's been out of stoneflies on the top, what happens is the stoneflies then, after hatching in the sun, die and go beneath the surface, and Paul figures this out, and Norman's not catching any. And when Norman's not catching any, Paul, seeing Norman struggle, comes all the way across the river and gives Norman the right fly, which Norman accepts. So again, Paul offers Norman help, Norman accepts it, Norman offers Paul help, Paul will have none of it. So we get to sort of see enacted in that transaction over what flies to use and the kind of relations between those two brothers within the broader framework of Paul taking Norman fishing this time to help him, this whole deeper sense through a reversal within a tragedy of help and helpfulness. And during that fishing trip, Norman has the following thought, right in the middle of this whole business with the stone flies. He says, while I was standing in quiet, shady water, I half noticed that no stone flies were hatching. And I should have thought longer about what I saw, but instead I found myself thinking about character. It seems somehow natural to start thinking about character when you get ahead of somebody, especially about the character of the one who was behind. I was thinking of how when things got tough, my brother looked to himself to get himself out of trouble. He never looked for any flies from me. I had a whole round of thoughts on this subject before I returned to reality and yellow stone flies. I was started by thinking that, although he was my brother, he was sometimes knotheaded. I pursued this line of thought back to the Greeks, who believed that not wanting any help might even get you killed. Then I suddenly remembered that my brother was almost always a winner, and often, because he didn't, borrow flies. Okay, now this is an extremely complicated point. One of the people who Norman read on tragedy was a man named Bernard Knox, who wrote a great book called Oedipus at Thebes. And what he argued in that book, in studying this great Greek tragedy, was this. We've been wrong, said Knox, for years in always looking for people having tragic flaws, and thinking that somehow the Greeks who wrote about tragedy, like Aristotle, were talking about something wrong, some great fault in a human being which led to their downfall. Knox pointed out that in this great play, Oedipus, that Oedipus, at the beginning of that play, is a great king whose relentless analytical intelligence has saved the city. Because when that play opens, Oedipus has solved the riddle of the Sphinx and spared Thebes a terrible catastrophe because he solved that riddle. He is a great human being with this capacity to figure almost anything out. But it's this relentless determination to figure things out that's the very source of Oedipus's downfall, because he's suddenly placed into a context where that relentless intelligence in trying to solve a murder, which everybody says you don't want to go there, you don't want to find out who killed Laius, because he's the one who killed Laius, right? And so the reversal is that the person who's trying to apprehend the criminal is himself the criminal, and he's undone by this great virtue of his. This relentless intelligence that once saved the city now is the source of his undoing, okay? And here you have, in this little passage I just read you, with Norman's mind going back to the Greeks, and he's going back to the Greeks because, as he says right here, on the one hand, not being willing to take any help can get you killed, but on the other hand, not being willing to take any help, okay, can also be a source of your greatness, as it was in Paul. And so this is a kind of knot that's both in Paul's mind, or head, as Norman calls him, knot-headed, but a knot that's kind of in Norman's as well. Yes?
In the film, though, doesn't Paul finally ask Norman, what are they biting on? Does he walk across the river to get the fly? Or am I remembering?
In the film, they do yell back and forth, in the film and in the story. What are they biting on? And in fact, Norman says in the book and in the film that this made his day, that his brother finally was asking him. In fact, his brother actually gets so frustrated that Norman's catching all these fish and he is not, that he throws stones over there and kind of ruins Norman's hole, right? This makes Norman feel great because it's an admission that on this occasion, his brother is so desperate and doesn't like getting beat that he's going to ruin Norman's hole with these stones. And then Norman, having already caught nearly his limit, yells across to answer his brother, who finally does say, what are they biting on? You remember exactly right. That's both in the film and it's also in the book. But in the book, when he yells back what they're biting on, the bunion bug is what they're biting on, and Paul says, oh, Norman says, do you have one? And he says, no. And Norman says, I'll come across and give you one. And in the book, no. Okay. Paul will not have anything of that. Later, though, he walks across and gives Norman this dead stonefly fly, which he has and which he begins catching fish on like crazy later in the narrative. Okay? So in the film, I actually can't remember, maybe you're remembering rightly, that in the film it may be that Paul comes across and gets a bunion bug from Norman. But it's crucial in the story that that doesn't happen. Paul refuses help to the very end. Okay, now I'm going to read you just one more passage, because here we have the father weighing in, the minister, on this whole question of help, and I think this may be something we'll want to talk about a little bit here. It's the evening now when Paul and Norman have come over to have supper with their parents. And at the end of the supper, Paul takes off to go to one of the poker games, the stud poker games, or to go to some bar. And this, of course, disheartens both of the parents. And Norman and his father are left alone, and this is part of their conversation. My father went to the door and looked out, and when he came back, he didn't ask me any questions. He tried to tell me. He spoke in the abstract, but he had spent his life fitting abstractions to listeners so that listeners would have no trouble fitting his abstractions to the particulars of their lives. You're too young to help anybody, and I'm too old, he said. By help, I don't mean a courtesy like serving choke cherry jelly or giving money. Help, he said, is giving part of yourself to somebody who comes to accept it willingly and needs it badly. So it is, he said, using an old homiletic transition that we can seldom help anybody. Either we don't know what part to give, or maybe we don't like to give any part of ourselves. Then, more often than not, the part that is needed is not wanted. And even more often, we do not have the part that is needed. It is like the auto supply shop over town, where they always say, "Sorry, we are just out of that part." I told him, "You make it too tough. Help doesn't have to be anything that big." He asked me, "Do you think your mother helps him by buttering his rolls?" "She might," I told him. "In fact, yes, I think she does." "Do you think you help him?" he asked me. "I try to," I said. "My trouble is, I don't know him. In fact, one of my troubles is that I don't even know whether he needs help. I don't know. That's my trouble." "That should have been my text," my father said. "We are willing to help, Lord, but what if anything is needed?" "I still know how to fish," he concluded. "Tomorrow we will go fishing with it." So now in this conversation, what's happened is that this whole very particular dynamic between these two brothers, which has played out primarily in Rivers, has now been elevated into a kind of universal problem that we all have to live through, and that is the whole conundrum of whether or not it's even possible to help folks, since we suddenly come to realize in this exchange that, in a way like forgiveness, help is something that requires that it be accepted before the transaction's complete. We can't help somebody unless they accept our help, and we can't help somebody, at least so as the father's arguing, unless we have understanding enough of them to know what it is they need and whether or not we have the right part to give them. But even to make things more complicated, they have to want to be helped in order for our being able to do this, even if we do know what they need and have the right part. So you see how complicated helping is. So in some ways, what that conversation invites us to wonder about is whether or not the kind of relationship between the two brothers, tragic as it is, really goes to point to at least one tragic dimension of the human condition. One tragic feature of all of our situations, and that we being finite beings and not being able to look straight into the heart of another, who always have to be to some extent strange to us, can't exactly know what they need, and even if we were to know, they would have to want it, and they would have to accept it in order for us to be able to help them. So it's a kind of two-way transaction, like forgiveness. Can you just forgive somebody, or do they need to accept it before you've actually forgiven them? Similarly with help, et cetera, et cetera. So now the father has kind of tried to lift this out of a kind of highly particular context into a more universal one. And as you'll see in the film tonight, after Paul is, and I'll just read you, this is a much shorter passage, after Paul is killed, the very last things the two men begin to wonder about is whether or not they could have helped Paul and thus prevented his death. So the father says, "Do you think I could have helped him? Even if I might have thought longer, I would have made the same answer. Do you think I could have helped him?" Answer was a question, of course. We stood waiting in deference to each other. How can a question be answered that takes a lifetime of questions? So that basically we're sort of left then, as the two men are, asking each other the same question, could I have helped him? And that could now has a much larger resonance than simply, was there anything I in particular could have done to help Paul, to the question, can any of us really help in some deep sense anybody else, given all of those things that have to be in place? Now, curiously enough, in the book, it's the mother who the narrator says finally gets it right. In a very often unnoticed passage, on just before the conversation I told you, and just after she's been informed of Paul's death, here is what the narrator says. My mother turned and went to her bedroom, where, in a house full of men and rods and rifles, she had faced most of her great problems alone. She was never to ask me a question about the man she loved and understood least. Perhaps she knew enough to know that for her it was simply enough to have loved him. In other words, the men are always trying to figure out how something they can do, some action, some particular form of service, some particular thing is going to solve someone else's problem and give them help. And for her, it was simply enough, she understood, to have loved him. And about as far as the men get at their best is to figure out, well, let's just go fishing. And fishing turns out indeed to be the medium within which the men work out these kinds of transactions that I've helped summarize. So it's not that they don't make any progress, it's just that they're unwilling to trust the sufficiency of love and always want to be doing something. We get back to that first passage I read about toughness and exertion and all of that. So that really, though they're gracious to one another, for neither of them, neither Paul or Norman, or even their father, is grace enough, is grace sufficient. There has to be something more. And for the mother, both love and grace were sufficient. They were, as I just quoted, they were enough, she thought. So that's a kind of just a tiny little opening into what I think is the larger theological issue the book explores. I'll talk more about that in a couple of days. Any questions? I have maybe a couple of other points, but I'd rather have you ask questions. Yeah.
This is an interesting thing, and what happened is when that movie was coming out, I was sitting in a doctor's office and I was reading an interview of Redford, and he was asked, can you try to summarize, which is a very, almost impossible thing to do, what this movie's about. And I never forgot his answer, because when I saw the movie, I didn't see it. He said, well, I think what it's mostly about is that middle-class people just can't show their feelings. That's how he summarized it.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's something to that. The shift in the diction that I pointed out from thinking to feeling, I think reflects the old man looking back and seeing how important that was. He says, the narrator, a couple of times, that this was a real problem that they couldn't, or they only rarely, expressed opening their feelings. You saw me read, or you heard me read from Jesse, who he says he thought he saw tears in her eyes, but he never saw her cry. So there is a kind of, especially, I wouldn't put it middle class, I would say that it more has to do, as he talks in here several times, about the Scots and their reserved temperament, which he does lift up as being a real problem. So I think he thinks of it less in terms of class than he does in terms of ethnicity here. But the point's well taken. The point's well taken. Yes?
I wonder if, I love exploring this idea of helping, and I wonder if intuitively maybe they just understood just accompanying, being with, it is help.
I think in some ways what the film shows us is exactly what you're saying.
To not give up, just to say, to be with them in, to be a witness to, because I'm sure those brothers knew, or at least I'm sure he knew that Paul was struggling with with his demons, whatever they were. And even, I just think it's helpful to show some restraint in not saying, do this, try this.
Yeah. No, that's very well said. In fact, that great fourth act begins, as I said, with this role reversal, and then and the narrator says, and I realized that Paul was being specially tender with me because he insisted that we fish together where we normally fish the waters alone. That is to say, they would go together, but then they would split up and fish separately. And this particular time, they fish together, and Paul insists on it, and Norman realizes this is really special. And it is just a matter of being together, as you're suggesting. So that's a very nice point. Yes?
To go back to Redford's summarization of the plot, doesn't McLean at the end of the story say something along the lines of, like, he never understood anyone that he knew in his life, even his wife?
There's a wonderful line in the book which is given to Norman. In the film, it's given to his father in a sermon. Those that we live with and love are the ones that most elude us, something like that. There is this other line, which again is given to the father in the film, but it's given to Norman in the book, which is that you can love completely without complete understanding. Okay. So what happens in the film is gradually there's a separation in Norman's mind between love and knowledge. He comes to see that you don't have to understand something fully in order to love fully, which is something that his mother has known all along, and that he only really comes to understand, I think, as an old man looking back and being able to tell his story. See what I'm saying? In other words, if you look at the last great section of this book, which I think I might send you off looking at, this last section of the film, begins, now nearly all those I loved and did not understand when I was young are dead, but I still reach out to them. The reaching out is a seeking to touch. And in reference to really Jesse, I never want to lose touch with you, okay? But when he says, I didn't understand them when I was young, suggests that in writing the story, which his father says he has to do if he's ever to understand Paul, has to write this story. If we had more time at another class, I'd show that in this book, the very germ of the story begins to form in Norman's mind, while, interestingly, sitting on the bank of a river. This sitting on the bank is a crucial location in this book. But anyway, the point is, he finally comes, I think, to an understanding by writing the story of this tragedy. But he didn't understand his brother when he was younger, though he came to understand that he could love him completely without understanding him completely. And for much of the story, he thinks that if he doesn't understand him, he can't love him completely, and hence can't help him. You follow me? So the relationship between love, knowledge, and helpfulness is very complicated in here. And I think only resolved in the end. Now, if this works, I'll show you this last scene. And on the theology part, I'm going to ask this question. I won't ask it now, because you're all hungry. How does this last great coda, which everybody remembers, resolve all of these conundrums I've been talking about? Because I think that it does, but to show how requires something more than we have. This is going to be now a kind of reprise of the scenes between the brothers before we get to the last part.
Now nearly all those I loved and did not understand my youth are dead. Jesse, but I still reach out to them. Of course, now I'm too old to be much of a fisherman, and now I usually fish the big waters alone, although some friends think I shouldn't. when I'm alone in the half-light of the canyon, all existence seems to fade to a being with my soul and memories, and the sounds of the Big Blackfoot River and a four-count rhythm, and the hope that a fish will rise. Eventually, all things merge into one, and a river runs through it. The river was cut by the world's great flood and runs over rocks from the basement of time. On some of the rocks are timeless raindrops. Under the rocks are the words. And some of the I am haunted by waters.
To see the whole film, come tonight after Vespers. And if you want to hear how this last great coda, I think, resolves a lot of these conundrums, come on the Theology of Norman MacLean, which will be 2 days from now. And the question you can all ponder, which I think is an important one, the title of this book is A River Runs Through It. And you hear that said here. Runs through what? What does it refer to? That'll be your question. Take care and thank you for your attention.